Welcome to this new episode of Spotlight on Africa, a podcast by RFI English, produced and presented by me, Melissa Shemam. Twice a month, I'll look at some of the biggest issues on the African continent. This week, we are discussing the issues of refugees, of displacement, and of another form of reparation. First, more than 120 million people are currently forcibly displaced by war, violence, and persecution, a number that the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, describes as a terrible indictment on the state of the world. The HCR last year declared 43 emergencies across 29 countries, including the Democratic Republic of Congo, Gaza, Myanmar, and Sudan. Sudan's civil war has been a key factor driving up the numbers, with nearly 11 million people displaced at the end of 2023. Of those, 9 million are internally displaced, another 2 million have fled to neighboring countries like Chad and South Sudan. Another consequence of the war has been the need for refugees living in Sudan to leave and to return to their home country. The UNHCR and the International Organization for Migration, IOM, have been working to address specifically the needs of South Sudanese refugees fleeing Sudan's civil war, which broke out in April 2023. I spoke to the IOM's emergency coordinator for South Sudan, Aaron Atkins, to know more about the situation on the ground.
In the northern part of South Sudan, the primary entry point into South Sudan has been a county called Renk. And basically, the last days of April last year in 2023 is when we started seeing significant numbers of returnees coming. These are South Sudanese who had been living in Sudan. The numbers of returnees that we had, especially in the first few weeks of May of 2023, were in the 1,500 to 2,000 a day range, with on the occasional day going as high as 2,500 people crossing the border into South Sudan every day. We did see different peaks along the way of Sudanese nationals coming across, some of whom sought refugee status and others moved into the country seeking mainly humanitarian assistance from various organizations, including IOM, UNHCR, the World Food Program, among many others, that had set up some operations in Renk town to deal with the arrivals. We had initially all agreed that we wanted to minimize the number of people stranded at the border, given that the area is quite isolated and can be quite difficult to provide services to people in need. And therefore, we set up a transportation assistance system led predominantly by IOM to move people from the border, from Renk town, onward parts of the country. Those are South Sudanese nationals that had areas that they could potentially return to. The South Sudanese made up the majority of the arrivals and have to date, given that with conditions in Sudan being so terrible, many people opted to say, well, let me return to South Sudan. Let me try and link up with family members or relatives in various parts of the country and see if I can make ends meet. So the ethical decision, but also the most cost-effective decision, was taken to set up a very large transportation assistance system, which to date has assisted about 200,000 individuals to move from the border back to areas of origin or areas where they had family members around the country. That's been done by boat, bus, and airplane where necessary. We've at times been doing 6 flights every single day to move people home. So it's been a very, very large, complex operation, but ultimately serving the needs of those returning and fleeing from conflict in Sudan. One of the major complications has been also that the Sudanese nationals coming across and wanting to take refugee status. Basically, there's thousands of Sudanese nationals who've come across the border and are in pretty dire need of assistance and don't have their family or their local community into which they could integrate. And so they're nearly completely reliant on humanitarian assistance for the time being. And they've come across a number of different border points, but as with the returnees, the refugees have predominantly come across into Renk County. And that's mainly because Renk County has the most infrastructure connected directly to Sudan.
Did you have to deal with potential conflicts between the two type of populations, the South Sudanese coming back and potential refugees from Sudan? Is it a worry on your side, or is this completely separate routes and easier to just focus on one problem at a time?
from our perspective, the Sudanese people that have come to South Sudan seeking refuge have come alongside the South Sudanese, and they are, you know, neighbors with a storied past. People are living together, in this case, different nationalities, but also different tribes and different ethnic backgrounds and different religious backgrounds. They're living together in the transit centers, waiting onward transport or awaiting other assistance. And they're doing so peacefully, especially when communication is clear and when there's good information about what services can be made available to them and what support can be made available to them. For the most part, people have been very forward thinking, I think, about their situation and looking towards what solutions that we can provide them and what they can do for themselves. And as a result, there's been very limited conflicts between the different communities that have come across the border. That's also included, especially the beginning of the conflict in Sudan, a number of third country nationals. So we had Ugandans, for example, a number of Kenyans, Ethiopians, even some Americans and other nationalities, all of whom have been assisted by IOM and coordinated through their respective embassies.
What are the main challenges and the needs an organization like IOM and your partners foresee? And what is the call you make to, for instance, the international community? Is it access to food or transporting food? Is it climate, the heat, I guess, or some other dangers that you need to face that were not easy to foresee before the war started?
The continued challenge is the lack of infrastructure in the area. We're talking about a very remote part of South Sudan. And though the infrastructure from Sudan down to Rank County exists, from Rank County moving south, there's very little infrastructure. And so the operation remains quite expensive to move people. We're having to use a lot of flight, where in another circumstance, you might use the public transport, buses and other things. That's not a possibility in this area where we're working. So it remains costly, and we continue to do resource mobilization from our various donors. Where possible, they've stepped up. The international community has various crises going on around the world, and so resources have been stretched thin. But we continue to be as efficient and effective as possible in allocating the limited resources we have to ensure the greatest impact. I would say that another challenge that South Sudan is facing, and that affects IOM and our operations and absolutely our beneficiaries, and that's a deteriorating economic situation in the country. The main source of revenue for this country is some of its natural resources, particularly oil. And the pipelines have been cut off because of a number of issues, but primarily because of access to them and maintenance and other things, and then access to the ports. And so that reduction in oil revenue into the country is putting a lot of pressure on the entire population of South Sudan. So the returnees are finding themselves coming into a country, into a situation that has an economic crisis of its own. There's a lack of employment opportunities, and making reintegration into the country that much more difficult.
This was Aaron Atkins from IOM in South Sudan. Now, another example on the other side of the continent, and a more positive one. In Mauritania, where 91,000 Malian refugees have been fleeing violence for over a decade, the situation is more optimistic. It is much more stable than the rest of the Sahel, as Marybeth Black, head of programs for the World Food Programme in the country, told me. It has become a leader, not only in Africa but beyond, in terms of welcoming refugees, drawing lessons from NGO, governments and future waves of displacements. Here is more with Marybeth Black from WFP.
Mauritania is incredibly stable for the moment and is really sort of, as we say, the eye of a hurricane in terms of stability across the Sahel region. It's also a country that has been really a leader, not just in West Africa, but across the continent and beyond, in terms of welcoming refugees into its country, allowing them to have access to social services and social protection programs in a way that you don't see in many countries across the globe. In terms of the last few months of refugees from neighboring Mali coming into the country, and this influx has been rather consistent since about October and continues until this day. Of course, Mauritania has hosted Malian refugees since 2012, and we've seen a very slow influx of refugees over the last decade. However, with the withdrawal of the MINUSCA troops in December in Mali, we've really seen an uptick in the number of refugees entering into Mauritania, Sharqi region of the country, which has a very large and porous border. Now, it's important to note that prior to this last large, the vast majority of refugees were coming and residing in what we call the Embera refugee camp, the only refugee camp in Mauritania, and it's actually so large these days that it's considered the third or fourth largest town in the entire country after the capital and a few other cities. What's different about this most recent arrival of refugees is the vast majority are choosing to remain outside of the Embera refugee camp, meaning that they are installing in local Mauritanian communities and thus using the same resources the local Mauritanian population is using. Mm-hmm. Now, the Haut-Ashagari region is quite fragile. It's also one of the regions that's being hit the hardest by the cyclic drought that's taking place now until September. And so you can imagine that having a large influx of refugees that are also coming with large herds of animals is putting significant strain on already fragile social services and already fragile communities.
From what you said, I think what's interesting about Mauritania is that you seem to have evolved towards a solution. And I think the points of integration into the country, it seems like bringing a bit of hope. Do you think it's the results of good work from the NGOs in the UN, or do you think it's specific to the country, or do we have a chance that maybe this model could help the wide discussion around how to support displaced people all over Africa and maybe even beyond in the world?
I mean, I think it's important to first and foremost salute the government of Mauritania, which has really been a driver in terms of accepting refugees within its borders. I think it's important to note that refugees have access to some of the social services that other most vulnerable Mauritanian households have access to, such as the Takeover Program, which is the National Social Cash Transfer Program, for which there are over 43,000 refugees who receive quarterly cash transfers from the government of Mauritania to cover their basic food and non-food needs. And so that's really huge and something to really be applauded. It's also been the social registry of the government of Mauritania itself that's taken the lead on targeting of those individuals. So while they have received pecuniary and technical support from the World Food Program, as well as UNHCR, it is indeed the government that's in the driving seat for some of these programs. Refugees have also been eligible for healthcare schemes through the government of Mauritania. There's freedom of movement, which is something you often don't find in refugee camps. Refugees can come and go from the refugee camp as they please. A lot of them are transhumanist and or pastoralists, and so you see them leaving the refugee camp with their herds of animals and coming back. So while I do believe that WFP, UNHCR, and a myriad of other actors have played a significant role in helping guide or bolster policy, it's really worth noting that the model here in Mauritania and what the government has done is something that really should be saluted and celebrated as a model that really could be adopted in other contexts in sub-Saharan Africa or frankly across the globe.
This was Mary Beth Black, Head of Programs for the World Food Program in Mauritania. And to close this episode, we talked about reparations earlier this month in the form of financial compensation for former colonized countries, descendants of enslaved people, and in the case of climate injustice. As the issue is gaining momentum in the global south, especially the Caribbean and Africa, one artist has been addressing the debate through his installations and photographs, the French-Algerian Berlin-based Kader Atia. The artist is back in France for a new exhibition at Montpellier in the south, titled Descent into Paradise, inspired by both his travels, his displacement, and the world-renowned book by Dante, The Divine Comedy. I met him at the MoCo, the Museum of Modern Art of the city, to discuss his vision on his theme of repair and how to help our societies move forward from collective past traumas.
My name is Kader Atia. I'm an artist, and I have been working and thinking for a couple of, let's say, decades now. I grown up between France and Algeria. My teenage time was in France. And all my practice is about the question of repair and has a sort of agency that moves both culture and nature. It's my kind of sort of magnificent lens that helps me to see the world and the mankind, both sometimes in a very close up, you know, in a very close way, and some other through a sort of bigger picture. Yeah.
Here we are for a new exhibition. You're back in France for the first time in a few years. Mm-hmm. How did you adapt to this space, and what did you want to say to this audience in Montpellier?
Going down through spaces to see art, for me, makes a different sense with what we do expect in art in general, in exhibition. We always have this sort of expectation that going through art or as a viewer, as audience, we go up actually, and we climb. This kind of idea of elevation, intellectually, physically, etc. This significant part of the architecture of the space, which calls the visitors to go down from one room to another one, inspired me this idea of going down to hell that Dante in the Divina Commedia has described, which description still is relevant today, even stronger, particularly with this idea that I had it, that actually the paradise is not up to the sky, but down underneath our feet.
At many points we discussed the fact that this exhibition works like a journey, and it starts in Algeria, where you spend a lot of time in your childhood. Can you explain how this country has been important to your art?
Algeria is definitely very important for all the Algerian, even living under another national identity in Germany, in France, whatever, who actually honor the legacy of their ancestor. I've grown up in a family where both poverty and strength in the east of Algeria, in the Aurès, in the mountains, have been a significant boost for emancipation. And I was talking in the exhibition about traces also. As far as I'm concerned, the traces of my families, I mean, I knew my grandmother, she was a Mujahideen, my father too, Mujahideen. I really care about this idea that even if we can be several people, several cultures inside, several genders, several identities, there are some of them which are stronger, and you cannot get rid of them like this, even if you want. And the influence that Algeria has in my desire to share with the world a room to meet and exchange and grow together is particularly poetical. It goes through foods. In the exhibition, there are elements where I use actually ingredients of food. These bread, matloua, that is the bread of the region of where I grew up, you know, of my family in Algeria. From the French used to call the bread matloua, bread of the Aurès, le pain des Aurès. Matloua, that is inserted in the wall, facing the video of a cube of sugar melting itself because I poured on top of it oil, black oil. These very important tagine plates that have broken. These are the plates we use to prepare matloua. And the matloua of my childhood fascinated me. I was fascinated by these traces on the bread because they were like drawings. You see, so here is the influence, a part of the influence. Of course, the influence also goes through the first room where the series of rochers carrés, square rocks, an area of Bab El Oued where, when I was very young, I used to go and to hang out there with my cousins to swim beyond these blocks. But these are one of the examples. There are others. But there is a significant influence, and also, of course, an invisible one.
Your art is very often described as very political, but it's obviously much more than that. And do you agree with that statement? And how do you feel in a world where everything is both political and impossible to talk about?
The most important is from which position you are enunciating your art. As far as I'm concerned, with what I told you about the influence of my own story, when I was a kid, I was tired of going back and forth between France and Algeria. And my father one day told me, you know, as a migrant, you should not be sad to lose your friends. Remember one thing is that as a migrant, the most important is not the country you leave and neither the one you will find. The most important is the journey. I grew up with this, and this vivid quote is still really animating me in my own practice. And I would say the most important is not to be neither political nor poetical, but is going back and forth between these two. Because art is all about what you don't see, actually. Of course, I'm addressing political questions sometimes that are very clear, but I'm also addressing them through the lens, like I did downstairs with this work, Intifada, or The Rhythm of Revolution. I'm addressing them through a metaphysical and philosophical purpose. I don't want to get trapped into something that, in the end, would be easy to target. I really think that resistance is a form of existence. I wrote a text in the catalog called Resistance. I think we also should be able to re-elaborate a more subtle capacity to echo the complexity of the society rather than to be like, you know, this kind of very limited and cliché statements and way of so-called way of thinking that you can summarize with one word. He's political. She's queer. She's a feminist. What does it mean? I mean, there are millions of ways of being feminist or queer or anti-colonial, you know. I don't think that ontologically each human subject, you, me, all these people around us, all these people listening us, are just one single subject. I think we are composed with almost an endless, but at least several subjects. And this is important to understand that, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that you cannot summarize a practice as, you know, such or such.
Of course, one of the themes that comes around often in some of this artwork that we've seen before is the idea of repair. Mm. And that takes us to a very spiritual approach through nature that you film. So how did you push this forward for you? You go from Aldera to Thailand, basically. You wanted to explore new side of this idea of the ghost, the spirit. How do you make that come across visually and into an artwork?
I think we need to challenge our mind. I mean, I've always been like recently walking and fascinated by Southeast Asia. I did another project in Vietnam, in South Korea. I think the idea of changing is very important. Changing by absorbing all the dynamic that can elaborate a much more complete conversation.
This was the latest episode of Spotlight on Africa, a podcast produced by RFI English. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back soon to comment on other African elections, especially in Rwanda. In the meantime, for more African news, go to our website, rfi.fr/en.